afternoon. I appreciate those of you that were able to stick around this afternoon, and especially we'll be back for our session, our banquet tonight, and have a chance to hear our president, Dr. Dockery, especially with the topic he's going to be addressing. But I will be the first to admit and confess that, you know, as a pastor, preacher, this is a little different venue than I'm accustomed to. Usually on Sundays when we preach, we don't give people a chance to ask questions, you know, when we finish, and that's always a little bit challenging. But I've appreciated so much what we've heard, and it's been a blessing to watch how God, though we've known the topics, none of us have known what the others were actually doing in their preparation time, and how God has sort of woven those things together to give us a clear message. Dr. Akin this morning talking about the hills to die on, so much with, and being having the wisdom to know which hills to die on, and I've thought so much about that in my preparation for this morning. When I was a pastor at West Jackson a number of years ago, some of you were actually remember this episode, but we were in a business meeting right before we were to relocate, and we had a presentation to proceed with about a $12-15 million relocation project. That was back in the mid-90s, and so that was a whole lot of money back then, and I'll never forget the business meeting, that the motion was made, quiet presentation made, less than 5 minutes of discussion, almost no discussion, then the church voted unanimously to move forward. Now, that's not the end of the story. The very same night, our kitchen committee presented a motion that we increased the Wednesday night meal by 25 cents. We spent 45 minutes debating that motion before I think it may have failed like 60-40 or something. But I think, you know, that's okay. I think we ought to ask God for the wisdom to know where we take the stand and where we rejoice in our diversity. And so this afternoon, in my topic on the awakenings, I hope that some of what I will share will be fruitful, and hopefully some things you've not heard before. One of my favorite places on the planet is the land of Israel. And one of my favorite places in Israel is the Dead Sea. Some of you have been there many times like I have. But the Dead Sea is it's an interesting place for a lot of reasons. It's 47 miles long, getting smaller every day if you've been there recently. It ranges from 2 to 10 miles in width. It's 1,300 feet below sea level. But its salt mineral content is 25%. The regular seawater is about 6%, which means nothing lives in the Dead Sea, thereby called the Dead Sea. But what you may not realize if you've never been there is the Dead Sea is fed by the waters of the Jordan River. The Jordan River is fed by the waters of the wonderful Sea of Galilee, which is the most important item of security in the land of Israel. That's their body of life. But the Sea of Galilee is fed by waters like the snowmelt waters from Mount Hermon. The point I'm making is the Dead Sea receives pretty good water. The difference between the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee is that the Dead Sea has no outlets. It just takes and never gives. And I've thought a lot about that as I have prayed about, studied, prepared this presentation dealing with the awakenings. We as Baptists and evangelicals have always been at our very best when we not only allowed God's Spirit to flow to us, but through us. And I think we're always in danger when we ask God to do something in us that we're not allowing or not willing to allow Him to bless through the lives of others. My time today is going to focus on the last 400 years when we've been willing to allow God to use us to change the world. I'll confess that I have thought that I was somewhat of a student of the awakenings and missions and evangelism, but I'll admit to you that in the study and preparation for this event, I realized that I had studied the awakenings and revivals based on the sermons or lectures or lessons that I was going to teach, meaning that I took what I wanted to take from that to sort of illustrate the message that I was sharing. And so I think I went at it with a much more objective approach this time around. And I know none of you would never have that tunnel vision, but I had that. But this has led me to present my work today in the form of some myths surrounding the Great Awakenings. And let me say, as I sort of lay out a historical view of the Awakenings and share about their impact on Baptist missions and evangelism, I discovered that not only do pastors disagree, but historians agree even more about key events in the time of those events. And so the fruits of my study will revolve around the concept of the myths and truths and results of the Awakenings as they apply to us today. It actually begins with sort of thinking about the term awakening. I'm not real sure, and I'm not going to open up the can of worms of trying to change the title of the Awakenings, but I'm not sure awakening is the best word to use in reference to these events, because the word awakening sort of refers to, at least in my mind, it carries the idea of a personal sort of self-spiritual enlightenment, you know, that we have awakened to something, where in a close look at the Awakenings, it was more of an outpouring and infusing of God's Spirit on God's people. It had less to do with what man was doing and more to do with what God was doing. But I won't get into all of that. But I do want to begin by sharing with you myth number one that I discovered in looking at the Awakenings is, first of all, that there is agreement on the number and the dates of the Awakenings. I had assumed that everyone agreed on the number of Awakenings that we have and the dates of those Awakenings. And let me say to you, I think I'm on the slide here, the second two Awakenings, the Awakenings from 1850 to almost 1900, very little debate upon the timing of that Awakening. And the general Awakening, and we've only started using the term Awakening to the 1960-1980 time only recently, but it's being used now. Not a lot of debate about that, but the first two Awakenings, I think there's room for some discussion. Now, in thinking about the latter Awakening, which I'm not going to spend a great deal of time today talking about, but I do want to ask the question, thinking about the years of 1960 to 1980, many of us came to know Christ during those years, and thinking about the fact that so much of the results of the Awakenings and the impact of the Awakenings, that it touched the lives of young people that seemed to spill over, I think if I just want to ask the question here, if you became a Christian, in other words, you made a confession of faith in Christ before you were 18 years of age, would you raise your hand? Now, y'all look around the room here. All right, you can put your hands back down. I only share that because I think it may say something about how we ought to bend our strategy, because younger hearts seem to be, not that we need to overlook any age, but younger hearts seem to be more sensitive to the gospel. But there is disagreement about the dating of these first two Awakenings. Let me share with you what I mean by that. I found these first two dates that you see up ahead in question. The first Great Awakening, the years of 1730 to 1755, and then 1790 to 1840. As long as you're looking at it on paper, there's no real problem with that. But when you start looking at the events, documented events that occurred and outpourings that spill over between these two segmented times, it leaves you with the impression that this so-called first and second Great Awakening may have been very much of a single Great Awakening. I share that because the Awakening started in the United Kingdom about 1735, and almost simultaneously started in colonial America. As the Awakening waned fairly quickly in the United Kingdom, at least compared to the Americas, it did ignite and spread in the new American colonies with great fervor. And when the awakening started in this country, it plateaued in some areas. But as soon as it plateaued, it seemed to reignite in other areas. And so rather than being one large movement or awakening, it would be better characterized maybe as many regional movements of God's infusion or anointing on the gathered body of believers. This first great awakening was, as many of you know, marked by famous sermons, one like Jonathan Edwards, Sinners in the Hands of the Angry God, July the 8th, 1741. And while the names of men like Edwards and John and Charles Wesley and George Whitefield are certainly names that we associate with this first awakening, names like Andrew Fuller often get overlooked as it relates to the awakening, simply because he was not really at the beginning of this first great awakening. But this is where the dating, sort of the dating comes into play. Fuller, or Fullerism, was actually the zenith. If you look at his ministry and the things that he was doing, it actually was the zenith of this revival that we saw in America. But most of his efforts occurred after 1780 and before this time that seemed to symbolize the beginning of this second great awakening, when he wrote the gospel worthy of all acceptation. I was surprised to find out, I knew about Fuller's biography, but didn't know a lot about his personal identity. He was a very intimidating presence. He had been a wrestler as a young man. He was a very physical presence, and he loved the idea of study. As a matter of fact, you may or may not be surprised to know that while he wrote against and rejected hyper-Calvinism, he did not reject Calvinism outright. One interesting caveat about this is that he was so committed to study time and spending deep, committed time with the Lord in study that he was very reluctant to be disturbed by visitors. If visitors would casually drop by, he would stand in the door frame, blocking their entrance to sort of quickly dispense with what they wanted. And he always pointed to a little plaque in his study that said, "He who steals my purse steals my money, but he who steals my time steals my life." And that's how he viewed his study time. It also seems that William Carey was greatly influenced not only by the early fathers of the awakening, but even most influenced maybe by Fuller's fervor, at least if you look at some of the things that happened about that time. And then we see the development of the Baptist missionary movement. And in my opinion, if anyone were to suggest that Fuller did not have an impact on William Carey and his inquiry and the influence on this missionary movement, they are that he in no way had a role in the awakenings, are greatly confused about the dates and the role and the impact of the awakenings. Now, I know that some people would say that what happened with even the formation of the Sunday School Board, I think in 1891-92, and then with the with what took place with Carey, would suggest those are lingering results of the Great Awakening. They would be surprised to know that in other parts of the country, these new fires of revival were still breaking out. These outpourings, as they called them, were occurring. So if the year of about 1790 to 1810, if these were years of intermission, God didn't know it. Because I'll give you an example. I was able to find in some letters that were written by people that were impacted by this time of awakening. This one letter written by Colonel Robert Patterson to Dr. King, September the 25th, 1801, says, "On the 1st of May at a meeting at Fleming Creek, Kentucky, about 60 persons were struck down, publicly confessing sins, praying for pardon, recommending Jesus to sinners. On the next Sabbath, over 100 persons were struck down in the same manner. A great solemn appeared all day." It's an interesting difference there than what we see in the aftermath of this awakening of 1850 to 1900. It seems that when God did this, there was a solemn among people. As God, there was rejoicing. There was cries of distress among sinners, praying and singing. First, about 4,000 people attended. 12 wagons brought numbers of people from great distance with provisions to last, the letter says. The Lord's Supper was to be held at Point Pleasant on Stony Creek the next Sabbath. The flame spread more and more. About 40 wagons, 4 carriages in all, about 8,000 persons showed up. 350 confessions of faith in Christ. 250 people struck down. And then goes on to say there was opposition by some pretending Christians and also by deists. But that's not an exception. There's account after account after account of people that talked about and witnessed to these fires igniting all over the country and even out in the West. But so I would say then that myth number one, that there is some level of agreement or there is great agreement on the dates of the awakenings, there is disagreement. Well, I don't expect everyone to jump on this this bandwagon with me in putting these two awakenings together. I would simply say to you today that whether two awakenings or one great awakening in two stages or one long awakening that waned in some areas as it ignited in other areas, it must be concluded that this anointing began with Wesley, Edwards, and Whitfield was the same inspiration that touched the life of Fuller, Carey, and others later in the century. But myth number two is, and I think there's a great application for this second myth for us today, was that removing barriers of offense to unbelievers will lead to larger church membership. That removing barriers of offense to unbelievers will lead to a larger or greater church membership. It may or may not surprise you to know that the strategy for removing barriers of offense to non-believers was not birthed in the seeker-friendly movement of the 90s. Whether it was the General Baptist, the 1700s, in their embracing of Unitarianism, or in an effort to appeal to those who were bound by the world's influences, or if it was the old light hyper-Calvinists who believed that you were so secure in your election that habitual sin prompted no need for rebuke, which was really no different than the Gnostics of the first century, we church leaders, all of us, have always been tempted to acquire a crowd through human persuasion rather than conversion. But a close look at messages like Jonathan Edwards, many of you have read this message many times, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, where he described the sinner as a loathsome spider suspended by a slender thread over a pit of seething brimstone. Or even Fuller's work later, The Atonement of Christ, when he said that we should hold up the blessings of his salvation for acceptance even to the chief of sinners. Or when he chided his fellow pastors by saying, I conceive that there is scarcely a minister amongst us whose preaching has not been more or less influenced by the lethargic systems of the age. It seems that during the time of the awakening, whether in the cities of New England or the prairies of the West, the preaching of the narrow road leading to life in Christ did more to increase church membership than a road made easy by powerless preaching. Whatever else you may say about the awakenings, the standards of membership increased, but church membership grew as well. Referencing an event that took place in the 90s, a large evangelical church in Texas, a friend of mine in his book on Common Sense Church Growth, noted that a large evangelical church actually set up a wrestling ring in their sanctuary on Sunday morning. So that their ministers could throw one another around the ring on Sunday, having been trained by folks from the WWF to the delight of the congregation. It drew a crowd. I don't know how many people were converted, but sometimes that temptation that if we attract a crowd, we've achieved the objective, that certainly was not the case with the awakenings. And in his book on Common Sense Church Growth, he made the observation, which with which I agree. He said, those from the world who are seeking and looking, they're looking for something not found in the world. They've tried the world's way and they're looking for something separate from the world. They're looking for something different. They're not looking for a world like itself in the church. After all, Jesus himself did not lower the standards. As a matter of fact, the day that he preached the Sermon on the Mount, he opened a 5-gallon can of worms. There wasn't a Pharisee or Sadducee within earshot that wouldn't have given the last denarius to see him strung up by sundown by the time he finished this sermon. Because in this sermon, rather than broadening the way, Jesus said, you've heard it said, do not murder. For whoever murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you, he who hates his brother will be subject to the same judgment and guilty of murder. That doesn't sound like lowering the standards. And we've all heard it said and preached that when Jesus is in the house, people will come to the house. I believe in that each of the awakenings, people had a sense that God was there. And they didn't want to miss it, even if it meant camping out day and night, lest they miss the outpouring of God's presence. Myth number three. And this one will make headlines for those who know me well. The awakening, myth number three, is that the awakenings were the result of a pushback from Calvinism. Now, those, as I said, who know me well know that I have never been slightly confused as a great defender of Calvinism. As a matter of fact, there were a few times that I was afraid if I logged on to the founder's website, there'd be a most wanted their posting of me, dead or alive. But I have to also confess that in watching the awakenings and the number of conversions that took place, I had made the assumption for years that because of the number of conversions, that the awakenings must have been some sort of pushback from the Calvinism of the day. But a close examination reveals something a little different, especially in the early years of the 1730 to 1830. Because in those years, you'll find that the context, at least in the initial awakenings, occurred among those who were not hyper-Calvinists, but were strongly Calvinist preachers. It seems that the true Calvinists were the ones who actually were successful in beating back hyper-Calvinism of those like Tobias Crisp and the Oldlights. I personally believe, and you may disagree, that it was men like Avery Jackson and Abraham Booth, both particular Baptists and Calvinists, who sought to stamp out the non-missional hyper-Calvinism with works like the Reign of Grace. These were preludes to the Great Renewal. And I would say to us this afternoon, if Jonathan Edwards could influence the missionary movement of William Carey, and George Whitfield, a diehard Calvinist, could partner with the Arminian Wesleys, then surely we can find mutual ground that allows us to move forward as Southern Baptists for the sake of reaching the lost for Jesus Christ. Now, the awakening of 1850 to 1900 was marked more by what has been labeled as a practical Arminianism. I'm not real sure what that is. I just know that if you read Charles Finney and some others, Beecher and Asbury, you get sort of a flavor of what that term may be what it carries. But it can be argued that their focus was a little more experience-based rather than doctrinal-based, which is to take nothing away from the good results of that awakening between 1850 and 1900, of which Moody sort of concluded those times. But it would do us well to remember that it seems that there were more unfavorable offshoots of that second awakening, although the awakening of 1850 to 1900, in terms of some non-doctrinally sound groups like the Mormons and others, than we actually saw in the First Great Awakening. If there was a pushback that helped spur the First Great Awakening, it started with the sermons of Solomon Stoddard in 1679, as he embraced heavily the great gulf that between the sovereignty and holiness of God and the depravity of man. The pushback of Stoddard was in response to Isaac Newton's Principle of Mathematics, which attempted to close the gap in the ability of man to discover the formula for the universe and the control of his own destiny. And while I certainly don't pretend to be an end-all authority on this, there did not seem to be a denial, even by these great preachers, of the science of Newton's thought, but simply his suggestion that man could scarcely control his own destiny. Myth number four, and please on this one, hear me out before you turn me off. Myth number four, prayer meetings were the catalyst for the awakenings. Now, I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand, but if I were in a crowd like this 6 months ago or before, and someone asked me if you believed that prayer was the catalyst for the awakenings, raise your hand, I would have raised my hand, because I've always heard, always believed, that prayer is the catalyst for revival and God's awakenings. Again, I ask you to please hear what I say and what I do not say, because I do agree with what Charles Finney said, I believe, when he said that revival has not come every time people prayed, but it has never come when people did not pray. I know the great story of Jeremiah Lampfear and the Fulton Street Church and the great prayer meeting that began there. I've even had my own personal experiences with some of the wrong ideas about prayer. My oldest daughter, Chrissy, when she was about 4 years of age, I remember it was a Tuesday evening. I had gone home. It felt like I had done about 15 funerals that day and had had calls about the fact that the flags, American flag, Christian flag, were on the wrong sides of the sanctuary. You know, we deal with that all the time, especially around Vacation Bible School. And that night as we were saying our prayers, Chrissy, 4 years old, buried her head in her little hands and she started to pray. She was mumbling and I could not hear her. And I decided this was a teachable moment. And I stopped her and I said, Chrissy, I can't understand a word you're saying. And she looked up at me as only a four-year-old can and said, Daddy, I wasn't talking to you. I think she had a great lesson for me in prayer. As a matter of fact, I must confess that while I'm talking about prayer and not being the catalyst for the awakenings, I must confess that the last 10 or 15 years of my pastoral ministry, that the thing that impacted me most was being a part or being the subject or the object of prayer partners, people that were over 100 people that were committed to praying for me every single day. And the way that that changed my life as a pastor is goes way beyond what my words could explain. So I certainly in no way would reduce the impact and power of prayer. But to call prayer the catalyst for the awakenings is to underestimate what God, I think, was really doing. I know, as I mentioned a moment ago, Jeremiah Lampfear with the Fulton Street Church, when he went in and started the noonday prayer times, started out with six people, and then there was 20, and then there was 40, and then there was 100, and then there were thousands. But a lot of people don't know that he spent the days before passing out some 20,000 flyers inviting people to come and pray. The point I'm making is that Jeremiah Lampfear personally sought God's face and hungered and thirsted for a movement of God in his own life and the lives of others. Or even as we think about the case of the Haystack prayer meeting of 1806, led by the students from Williams College, that inspired the burden for missions among young people. Even in that case, the prayer meeting became the context for revival, but not the catalyst. I think there's a difference in those two words. Prayer, I believe, is the greatest context for awakening, but it is not the catalyst for awakening. It seems that the greatest catalyst for awakening was the realization of God's holiness in contrast to man's sinfulness. We talk about that, we preach about that, we sing about that, we testify about that, but I'm not sure that we really experience that. The realization of God's sovereignty and holiness as opposed to our own depravity. But it does appear that when people called a fresh vision of God's holiness and sovereignty, that prayer became the natural response and therefore the context for God's refreshing. Don't think that the prayer emphasis was limited to 1850 to 1900. I know that that awakening of Finney and Moody and others became more associated with prayer, but the first great awakening Men like Isaac Backus and Stephen Gano prayed with expectancy for God's response. Gano once led a prayer meeting for rain in the midst of a great drought, and the young people left the meeting saying, "We must hasten home, for after a prayer like that, the rain shall overtake us." And it came to pass, within an hour, the rains came pouring down. I should say, and I am guilty as any of this charge, that with prayer meetings today having more resemblance to religious gossip sessions than true heartfelt desire for God's visitation, prayer might not even be the context for revival, much less the catalyst. Those are the myths, but what are the results? Very quickly, I will share just a few of these, what I think are overall results that impacted missions and evangelisms and even the way we do church. Result number one, that whether it was Edwards, Whitley, Wesley's, Backus, Stearns, Carey of the First Awakening, or even Finney, Asbury, and Moody of the Awakening of 1850 to 1900, the Awakening certainly led to a more fervent commitment to evangelism and missions. No one can argue that fact. But interestingly enough, in the Awakenings, the burden for foreign missions always grew out of a burden for reaching their neighbors and families. There ought to be a lesson in that. You know, the great heart cry for reaching people across the world started with their burden for reaching those immediately around them. The Society Mission Movement, the Triennial Convention formed in the tide of the First Awakening, and then, as you know, the Southern Baptist Convention formation in 1845 was actually, the formation was about developing these mission sending agencies, and it developed quickly into the Southern Baptist Convention and was sort of became the afterglow of this second time of awakening. And obviously, this second great awakening spurred the growth of Southern Baptist as well as its mission focus, and I'll come back to that in just a moment. The second result is that the awakenings led Baptists to cooperate with other evangelical types of the day. Now, I don't say evangelicals of the day because I can't find very many places where the term evangelical was used by writers of that day, but they were evangelical types because of some of the changes and moving around between denominations. And this may have been true more of the First Awakening than the Awakening of 1850 to 1900. It wasn't that Southern Baptists did not cooperate. It's just that at the birth of the Southern Baptist Convention, we grew at such a pace that we didn't think we needed anyone else. It wasn't a refusal to get along, just we were growing so fast we didn't think we needed anyone. I might say relative to the First Awakenings, Baptists were at first a little hesitant to embrace the awakening first ignited among the New Light Calvinists. But Richard Furman, Baptist of all Baptists, actually had a Presbyterian deliver his funeral message. He also had a contract put out in his life by the British because he was such a patriot. It should be noted that Princeton graduate James Manning was the founder of Brown University, the premier Baptist school of the day. It seemed that the greater causes of colonial America had a way of uniting like minds of Baptists and evangelical types of the day. Historians, not me, but legitimate historians suggest that the First Great Awakening unified as much as 80% of Americans in their common understanding of Christian faith and life. The third result, the awakening led to a greater need and desire for education for all. People, I think, who have not studied the awakenings would be somewhat surprised by that because they think about the camp meetings on the prairie and how even we as Baptists were quick to send out preachers that had not been seminary educated, which was necessary at the time. But because of that, I think there's a consensus, or at least a feeling, that the awakenings had really no tie to education. But if you'll look carefully, you'll know that the schools like Princeton, Brown, Furman, and others were the fruits of the First Awakening. The fourth result, the awakenings led to anti-slavery views, and a greater responsibility was felt for slaves and Indians as a result of the awakenings. Whitfield was the first preacher to preach to the slaves, or at least we're told. You'll be interested to know that a correspondent in Richmond County wrote this about what was happening, what God was doing. This was a secular writer, but he said, "When I go among Mr. Davies," talking about Samuel Davies' people, "religion seems to flourish. It's like the suburbs of heaven. Gentlemen praying their morning and evening prayers and their slaves devoutly joining them. I might also add that a greater respect for and the education for women grew among those of the awakening." Result number five, the awakenings waned not because of persecution from secular society, but from the religious establishment of the day. That should not surprise us. Whether we look back in Acts in the early church and the very first miracle from the apostles where Peter and John and the lame man from birth was healed at the temple gate, remembering that this lame man was not allowed to enter the temple because of his physical defect. The first day this man went to church in his life was the day that he was healed under the name of Jesus of Nazareth. And even though that great miracle was so obvious, they were brought not before the Roman government, but before the Sanhedrin, the religious establishment. Some things never change. And I might add that as popular as Jonathan Edwards was at the awakening, as it waned, Edwards, his pastor, caught some young people in his church looking at an obstetrics book containing the female anatomy, studying in less than in an educational manner, and he reprimanded them from the pulpit. Parents thought that he had overreacted. Does that sound familiar, pastors? And Edwards was banished from his pulpit, where he moved to Stockbridge and died working with the Indians. The awakenings waned not because of persecution from secular society, but because the religious establishment had had enough. So what do I conclude? It's this: that whatever else we may say about our desire and our need for an awakening, it seems to be clear that God visited His presence among His people in this unusual and sovereign way as a result of what I call the Isaiah 6 factor. You know the story of Isaiah. When he went to the temple to pray, as he goes in the temple, it appears that Isaiah is going there to pray on behalf of his people. He's going in as the best of the bunch in religious terms. But as soon as he gets inside, the place is full of holy and sovereign God. And Isaiah doesn't say immediately, "Woe is them." He said, "Woe is me," because he beholds the holiness of God. It boils down to what I've called relative and absolute holiness. Relative holiness is when we look around and we measure our holiness and our righteousness based on the lives of others. And relatively speaking, we think we're doing pretty well. But in the awakenings, people had a fresh vision of God's sovereignty and God's holiness, just like Isaiah. And it became a "woe is me" moment and event. And God visited His people. But as the awakening seemed to occur, not looking around for holiness, but absolute holiness. It is my heart's desire that the next cry that we hear from the Baptist family will be, "Woe is me, for we have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." And may we once again become the body of believers where the life of Christ flows not just to us, but through us. God bless you.
Thank you, Dr. Tidwell. Before he leaves, we would like to open the floor for just a few moments and see if you have any questions for him that he can respond to. We have microphones. If you would raise your hand, Dr. Patterson.
Oh, no, not him. I was hoping he wouldn't make it back.
Well, you started early, so I was late.
That was on purpose, Dr. Patterson.
I wanted to go back to this period, 1850 on, and you mentioned the Arminian kind of dominance in that awakening. It strikes me that one of the aspects of that was a movement toward a very strong emphasis on technique. And sometimes, you have to have techniques, you have to have methods, but sometimes those techniques led to manipulation and some of the more bizarre things that we sometimes associate with, you know, long invitations and other kinds of things that, that happened. Billy Sunday strikes me as one who was somewhat manipulative and also not really all that clear on the gospel when he gave his invitation. And so the question I have is whether some of that has been imbibed in Southern Baptist life, and that possibly some of the missing people in our churches who are on our rolls and never come, if there may be some connection between too much of an emphasis on technique and people who are not really regenerated and end up being, we now have a term in our church, sorry, some of our staff people are here, but we have a term called cold contacts. In other words, they're on our list, but they're considered cold, which I guess is better than being dead. But I'm wondering if in the revival tradition there were certain extremes that perhaps produced a kind of cheap grace and cheap discipleship that we now see the effects of in some of our church life.
One of the things I ran into, and I think I would be correct when I say this, that in the years of about 1850, early on in this, what I call the Second Awakening, not the early one, it seemed to be a little less of that. This practical Arminianism I talked about seemed to get more and more evident in those later years of the late 1800s. Now, I know that's not always the case, but there were some, and you've alluded to several of these, and you were kind on there, because there were some, as many of you know, there was some very not only less than legitimate techniques, but some really bad doctrine developed out of some of I think you're correct, maybe out of some of that manipulation where there was some unregenerate membership. And we've talked about this, and those of you know, my life has revolved around evangelism and methods for reaching people, but I think I have always feared that we make the mistake sometimes of telling people if they follow the right directions and say the prayer just right, that, you know, they're saved. And this whole confrontation with a holy, sovereign God that seemed to mark the awakenings, people don't seem to testify of that kind of experience. Not that every experience is that experience, but I do believe there's a legitimate conversion, regeneration. But I guess I'd just say, Dr. Patterson, you knew the answer before you asked, but I do think a lot of that was on the tail end of that more than the first end of that.
Dr. Davis, I think.
Could you give me an example of the Great Awakening in Tennessee in the 1800s? I'm just curious.
There actually. It was one, and I don't have all the details with me, but in Paris, Tennessee, in 1802, there was an account that was written about where I believe there was between 2,000 and 3,000 people that had gathered together, which those were extremely large numbers in those days. And again, this term struck down was used a lot, but that was during what I would have called that first time of the awakening, but. That was the only one that I actually singled out. Dr. Davis, those years that I mentioned, these in-between years between 1840 and let's say 18 1840 to 1850, and in about the turn of the century of the 1800s, between these two, well, the 1755 and 1790 and 1800, that these documented accounts that I mentioned were occurring, it seems, in places like Tennessee, Kentucky, and in the South, and moving toward the West. And these were occurring at times when the revival had waned northeast. And I think that's why there's a temptation to put such a long break between there, because the awakenings have been defined more, I think, at least the first one, by what was happening in the northeast more than the rest of the country. So,
okay. I had a reason for asking
you
that.
You don't get a follow-up.
Yeah, I do. Union University of Murfreesboro was founded in about 1845, somewhere like that. And you triggered a thought when you said a lot of colleges were founded. And I was just wondering if there was a Middle Tennessee awakening that might have impacted that. But that was just my curiosity.
I did not find that, but I'll sure look for it, because I did not pull that together. That's good.
Just want to ask, you know, whenever we look at the causes and results of revivals or awakenings, you know, sometimes those two things can be confused. I know, especially with like Finney's emphasis on methods to leading to revival, sometimes he brought in things that were a result of revival and made them causes. In some ways, when we think about trying to think about the decline of denominationalism, the decline of our churches, and we're looking for what are the things, when awakening came, what were the steps or the causes that led to this, and we go back and try to say, well, what will it take for us to do that? Are we sometimes going to fall into the trap of attributing the things that will cause our revitalization or awakening to things that can only be the result of awakening?
You know, that's a very, very good point. I think that may be why I was sort of led to focus on that prayer emphasis, because I had always thought as prayer as being this catalyst. If we had the prayer meeting in the prayer moment just right, then God would visit. And so I think your observation is a correct one, that we could focus so much on the results as being the primer more than it seems that. I'm telling you, the more you study, and I would just encourage you to take a look at the history of the awakenings, not just in a book that someone wrote on the awakenings, but read just some general history that allude to the awakenings. That way you're not getting any opinions, except and see that it really seems to be God sensing a real desire on his people to hear from him, but in a way that acknowledged his holiness. And I appreciated what Dr. Aiken said this morning about the styles of, you know, we need to be open with styles of worship. But I did like what he mentioned about, you know, if someone is being singled out as being the focus of the worship event, then God's not being singled out and God's not having the focus. And I do think we can get so casual that we miss God's sovereignty in that. But
we do one more question.
Of invitations of going down front from Finney.
No, actually, that came out of the first awakening and the new lights, because you know the new lights in the Presbyterian, they were really advocating a conversion experience, a experience with God. The old lights didn't think that you had to have that to be a part of the elect. So whether whether you agree with the election issue or not, the new lights believed that, and so there was a move to give people a chance to respond, but not near the mechanical and methodical way that we see happening in later years. And I'd say even with Finney, as much as I would disagree with some things that maybe Finney did, I use one of his quotes often where he said, "We can set the sails for revival, but only God can make the wind blow." The invitation was not the birth of those. It seemed to happen. Actually, it seemed to happen in the New Testament. So, but the some of the mechanical, I'd say, less fortunate methods came out of the Second Awakening. So. Not at all. I certainly, as I mentioned, there was some change in some assumptions I had made, but these were very practical assumptions of theology that I had. But doctrinally, you know, I guess I had always had a healthy respect for those who agreed in the whole sovereignty of God. But I can't say that I had a doctrinal or theological shift at all. I think I was challenged a couple of times along the way, but it did give me a whole new appreciation for the way those guys were able to rally around the most important things. And again, as I said, when you think about Whitfield and the Wesleys and how far apart they were, but you know how they were together, it's pretty admirable. So.
And Dr. Tidwell. Thank you, Dr. Tidwell, for a wonderful presentation. You're going to have an opportunity now for some free time this afternoon. We have a banquet beginning at 6 o'clock tonight and followed by our 7 o'clock presentation by Dr. David Dockery, our president here, and we're looking so forward to his thoughts